Feeling the pressure of your legs on the chair or the cushion. Heaviness. Perhaps some lightness. Some anchoring in the lower part of the body, perhaps, and some uplifting in the upper part of the body. And now you might do a little scan of your body, starting at the top of the head and relaxing the muscles in the face, the jaw, the cheeks, and even part the teeth slightly, and then bring the lips very gently together. Relaxing the shoulders, letting the arms just hang free, with the hands resting loose and comfortable on the thighs, or folded gently in your lap. And then just noticing if there are any tense or tight areas in your body, perhaps in the abdomen or the chest. Just see if you can breathe into those areas that you notice and relax them. We're about halfway through our sitting together. You notice that you're lost in thought, and just be mindful of that. Be mindful, oh, thinking about the past, or perhaps plans, planning for the future. And be mindful of that, note it, and then just come back gently to our breath. The movement of the in-breath and the out-breath in the body, in the belly, an anchor holding us here and now. Just opening to the river of our experience, the full river of our experience flowing by, whatever arises. We can welcome it, note it, and just let it be, come back to the breath. Bodily sensations, thoughts, emotions. Maybe images in the mind. The flowing river of our experience. We're standing on the shore, just observing. Welcoming awareness, whatever arises. Painful thoughts, negative thoughts, you just note them. Part of the mind's activities. You don't have to identify with them. Let them flow on. To end our sitting together, a few verses from the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's teachings on loving kindness. Let none deceive another, nor despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Welcome everyone, those in the hall, online. So happy you're here. Again, I'm Susan, Jim. Yeah, we're happy to be walking that with you all. You know, and it's a path that is one of the first teachings that people encounter when they come to study Buddhism and practice Buddhism. But it's a path that even the most experienced practitioners continue to walk, getting deeper and deeper and understanding more and more. So, but it is a place for, you know, newcomers to start, a very good place. So, you know, these past 3 months, this last month, this month, and the following, we're going to be focusing on wise speech and wise action and wise livelihood. And this is, you know, these are ethics in emotion. That is the definition we use, actually, for sila, ethics. And so, you know, this has a lot to do with our integrity, how we feel inside. Integrity, I like the second definition of it in the dictionary. Integrity, the state of being whole or undiminished. So when we speak of the Noble Eightfold Path, it's called noble because of the nobility we each possess as we walk this path. And there is a wholeness that comes from this unification, really, that we're cultivating within ourselves and with this practice. Body, mind, heart, bringing it all together. And with this process of unification, we can begin to feel in the body and the mind that more and more, we possess in place of a fragmented mind and heart that is divided within, we do begin to have experience a sense of wholeness, bringing body, mind, heart together, all together. So integrity, the state of being whole or undiminished. So before I talk more about this month's focus, wise action, I'd like to begin by touching upon, again, the interrelatedness of all the steps on the Noble Eightfold Path. And as we've mentioned previously, the steps do not unfold sequentially, even though that's the way we present them, but they're all interrelated, more like a circle and all of them influencing each other. And this is very clear, I think, when we look at wise intention, you know, which we talked about last November. You know, and with this month's focus, wise action, the interrelation of the interrelatedness of intention and action. The Buddha said, intention, I tell you, is an action. Through intention, one acts by way of body, speech, and mind. So, you know, when an unwholesome intention that we notice remains maybe just a passing thought, we can tolerate that, right? We have all kinds of negative, painful things that arise from time to time in the mind. You know, it's just part of being human. We can tolerate that. But once we put an unwholesome intention into action, suffering follows as the wheel follows the hoof of the ox, to quote a quote from the Dhammapada. So this month, we're looking at right or wise action. And, you know, I like the Buddhist focus, which places the emphasis on, you know, how can I be and act in the world versus the focus on kind of a more existential, who am I? So how can I be and act in the world? And so what I see is that this is because we really are defined, our lives are defined, our presence is defined by our actions. So we're mindful not of so much of who, but how. How am I living? So we have the tools of mindfulness, right? The tools to support us in this. So in November, when we were talking about wise intention, we saw how important it is to know, you know, why we're choosing to speak or act in a certain way. And how challenging it is sometimes to know what the true intention is behind a particular action, especially when we're not mindful. Especially when we're not attending to what we're saying and doing. And so then we can sometimes we fool ourselves into thinking that we're acting in a helpful, beneficial way, when really what we're doing, if we saw clearly, maybe some self-serving action we're taking in some way, self-serving in some way, or may even be causing harm. All those well-intentioned actions out in the world that don't often don't turn out so well. So we have these tools of mindfulness that support us in paying closer attention to our interactions with the world, to be aware before we act, as we are acting, and how our action landed in the world. We can look at that afterwards. And if we're walking this, if we're walking the Buddha's path to freedom from suffering, we want to attend closely to what we're saying and doing and bring awareness to these underlying intentions. And so, you know, this is how this practice that we do is so important. It helps us, it encourages us to slow down in life, but slow down as we interact with the world. It supports us in our ability to, you know, stay calm and see clearly as we go about our day. And of course, as we practice, you know, it opens the door to this inner life that we talk about, which if you've been practicing for a while, you have a sense of this inner life. And this is where our deepest intentions are formed and reside, right? We come to understand that. So I encourage you to, as you practice, as part of your practice, to take frequent pauses during your day. You know, as you go about speaking and acting in the world, we can pause sometimes, just a second or two helps. And we can ask ourselves, What's really at the root of what I'm about to say or do? It supports us in seeing clearly and calmly. And as we look at the root of what we plan to do or say, we can ask, you know, is there some craving, some strong wanting? Is there ill will or hostility at the root? Or is it about letting go? Or is it more goodwill or compassion that's at the root? And so as we become more mindful through our practice, we can use this type of reflection before we act and as we are acting, and then we can reflect after an action. And so this is the way we develop, you know, the mindfulness muscle, and we really can begin to see clearly how our actions do have consequences, right? We notice. And so then we have these precepts that are part of the Buddhist teachings on wise action. We have these precepts that can guide us, and they're very useful, you know, in the early years of our practice, before we have, you know, fully developed this mindfulness muscle, before we have fully opened our minds and hearts to the world. So we can use these precepts as a kind of a protection. We can protect ourselves and those around us from suffering by attending to these five precepts. So what are they? They're abstaining from killing, abstaining from stealing, abstaining from false speech, abstaining from sexual misconduct, and abstaining from misuse of intoxicants. So these are kind of like, I look at them as kind of like training wheels. And over the years, you know, as we practice, the precepts really become really ingrained or woven into the fabric of our being. And, you know, then we can kind of take off the training wheels, because we automatically respond in skillful ways. You know, ways that promote these good qualities within us, you know, goodwill and compassion, love, and all of those beautiful qualities that we have as part of our human hearts. And so in speaking about our human hearts, another practice that has been a particular support for me in my work as a healthcare chaplain is the Brahma Viharas. The Brahma Viharas, these qualities that are a beautiful support for us as we go about our interactions with others and with the world, as we're acting in the world. They're also known as the four divine abodes. What are they? Loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. And so as we focus on, you know, this month and on ongoing, as we focus on action out in our world this coming month, as we're walking the path, we can, we can see how the second divine abode, compassion, is all about action. It is loving kindness in action. So we take action. We take action with these divine abodes. We take action by cultivating a caring, loving heart. First for ourselves, having some patience for all our occasional fumblings around in life. Care and love for our dear ones, which sometimes can be even more difficult than giving it to strangers, a challenge, and care for, you know, all of our interactions with all the beings out there in the world. And we can recognize as we practice that those preoccupations around self, around me, myself, mine, you know, we can really see that it's so limiting, really. As we develop our ability to be aware, we can notice that, you know, self preoccupations really kind of close, they close and shrink our hearts rather than opening the heart. And we can see clearly as our practice unfolds that me, myself, and mine can be transformed. You know, we can open into us in place of me and mine, and we see clearly that, you know, we are all in this human life together with all its beauty and all its trials and tribulations. You know, we all of us, every human being, despite all our differences, we recognize that we have so much in common, right? We all have these bodies that age, that sicken, and eventually die. This is our human condition. And, you know, it is this recognition, I think, at least I know from my work on myself, with the work that I did in the hospital and in healthcare. And it's really this recognition that opens our hearts, the recognition that informs our actions in the world and towards one another. You know, we're all in this together, and we understand, we come to understand deeply the preciousness of this gift that we've been given, this gift of a human life. So the Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes, and compassion, karuna, compassion, loving kindness in action. So again, as our practice progresses, as our mindfulness muscle gets stronger, we understand really deep in our bones, we really feel the pain of any actions we've taken that involve killing and harming. How can we have this practice? We're practicing for peace of mind, right? To practice this peace of mind that we all desire. And this is the good kind of desire. Wanting this for ourselves, but we can't have it. We know we can't have it if we know that we've taken something that was given, or we've misused our sexuality in a harmful way. So peace of mind. And so attending to our actions is going to lead to more peace. Is it going to lead to suffering for myself and others around me? And so, and then we were given in the teachings, this mindfulness of the body. The Buddha gave us this tool. It's a powerful tool. And so mindfulness of the body, we feel right down to our bones, the guilt or the remorse that can come from unskillful harming actions. And, you know, it seems from my experience over the years, and I've been practicing and teaching for quite a few years, it seems what I find is that most people are engaged with this practice because they want peace of mind. They want peace in their hearts. And so, you know, these are the conditions of our inner state of being. And so we practice for our integrity that really nourishes our purity of heart. As Bhante Gunaratana says in his book, part of our studies in this program, he says, happiness requires peace of mind and a clear conscience. So sila, the ethics, we're on the ethics portion of the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, which is wise speech, now wise action, next month wise livelihood. And this part of the path really serves as the foundation for deep practice. So it prepares our minds and hearts, our inner space, for samadhi, for the concentration practice. And I think we can all understand from our practice that it's impossible to concentrate the mind when we spent our day feeding our wantings, acting out our grudges, going about heedlessly. We can begin to see more clearly that the purpose, actually, we begin to see clearly that the practice and that the purpose and goal, let's say purpose and goal, of many of the people around us in the world, the goal of those actions out there in the world is a lot about more money, more power, more prestige, right? And so we come to understand that this is not the true source of happiness, of peace of mind. As practitioners, we really do gain a deep understanding of this. And so as we're here today and when we leave here walking the path, it's clear that what's important to us, if we're here today, is more peace of mind, a feeling of well-being, which we can't have if we don't have a clear conscience. So this is the inner wealth that we talk about, this inner wealth that we're cultivating as we walk this Noble Eightfold Path. So sila, ethics, sila, there's a progression actually in our practice that you'll see as you continue on. Sila, ethics, samadhi, concentration, and panya, wisdom. And it all starts with our actions in the world, these ethics. If we don't, if we're not acting with care and love out in the world, it's going to be hard to go on to the next step in practice, this concentration that we talk about, samadhi. And then, of course, the wisdom and insight that comes with this practice as it deepens. So I'm going to end just with a quote from the Dhammapada. Gil Fronsdal's translation. One who does, these are the Dhammapada, these are the very earliest teachings of the Buddha, for those of you who aren't familiar with the Dhammapada. And they're offered in verse because in the Buddha's day, you know, this is how they memorized and repeated the teaching. So these two verses, one who does evil grieves in this life, grieves in the next, grieves in both worlds. Seeing one's own defiled acts brings grief and affliction. One who makes merit rejoices in this life, rejoices in the next, rejoices in both worlds. Seeing one's own pure acts brings joy and delight. So now, as we do, we're going to have, I guess we'll have the online people kind of meet together. And the people in the room, one group would be good. I have a topic for you to reflect on and discuss. Before we do that, does anyone have any questions or anything about what I've said so far? Okay. So here for your consideration. And wise speech, of course. So in keeping with our focus today on right or wise action, as Buddhist practitioners, we're encouraged to view our lives as verbs rather than as nouns. And so I really find this to be true, that we are all works in progress. Right, so selfing is a verb in our tradition. So, looking clearly and mindfully at how we interact with others in the world, our actions out in the world, at times we may find ourselves at one of the two unskillful extremes in the process of selfing. You know, either at one extreme, there's the self-effacement. You know, I'm not good enough. I'm not important enough. You know, what I say or do doesn't really matter. That's certainly a familiar one for me before I had this practice. And at the other end of the spectrum, kind of more self-promoting, you know, I'm really at the best at this. I don't really need to listen, or I already know this, or you know, I'm up here and they're down here. That's the other extreme. And so as part of this little activity, see if you can think of a time when you noticed that you had one of these attitudes, either I don't really matter, or the attitude I'm the most important one here. And did you notice the suffering involved in that? So that's the topic. And does anyone have any questions about that before we we'll get together for about, was it about 10, 15 minutes to discuss? Any questions? Okay. Well, then why don't you folks here in the hall can make a little circle and I can come and repeat some of that if you like, or if you're okay with it. A good topic for discussion.
Welcome back. We'll get ourselves in the room here rearranged and we can come together as a whole group after that.
Yeah, so now this is our opportunity to all come together, those online and those here in the room. And you know, just if there's anything that any of you would like to share that came out of your group experience, or perhaps someone in the group would be willing to, if not, if someone in the group would be willing to kind of summarize some of the things that were said, and then we will take a break. At 2:15, we will take a break. So in this group here in the hall, is there someone who might like to offer a little summary or just what came out of it for them, what was valuable to them here in the room.
I really appreciate it.
You do this so people online.
Well, is it working?
Yeah.
Yes.
You're good.
I just really appreciate our last speaker being funny about whether it's whether it's feeling like you're kind of above everyone else or feeling like you're kind of below everyone else. Either way, it's isolating and you are not feeling connected. So I can see that you're feeling the loneliness and just being summed it up.
So isolation, loss of connection, we do want to be connected. We're all in this together. So thank you for sharing that. Anyone else in this group wanted to share anything from the discussion? Okay. How about the folks online? There's someone who would want to summarize or just speak to your own experience. Yes.
Okay. I just want to say something kind of apropos and maybe a little funny that somehow I'm not feeling like good enough to be the one to share what you talked about and being at that end of that spectrum that I talked about at that in our breakout group that's where I usually land, and there have been times though when I'm almost pretending that I'm at the other end, that I don't want people to know that I don't know something, especially if it's something it has to do with my work, which is a very broad, area. But and then we did kind of talk a little bit about, or at least I did, I was a little lost of how does this actually even relate really to right action? Because both of these spectrums are something we don't want. So how's that a spectrum of right action? But then Carol that said, well, we want to be maybe in the middle somewhere. And maybe when we're aware of how we're thinking about our place on those ends of the spectrum, maybe we become aware of that, that can help inform us to choose a different action. Like I shared that I realized that I've been a little bit afraid of asking to have a mentor. Basically thinking I don't know enough to have a mentor or something like that. I don't know. It's kind of fuzzy, but I ended up agreeing that it probably would be a good thing for me to get a mentor, and I'm good enough to have a mentor. So I mean, I learned something weird about myself, I didn't really quite have that clear. So anyway, I wasn't going to try to summarize. So I don't know if Astrid or Carol, either of you want to say anything, please do.
Carol, did you want to go? Oh, thanks, Paula.
Nikki.
I think, we all kind of, well, at least Paula and I agreed that we weren't exactly sure how these examples related to right action, but I did my best. And when it came to the spectrum of, I'm the best and, I don't need to hear what they have to say or whatever. I've noticed that I've had moments where, in conversation and whatever context will come up around the topic of that's in the realm of my professional expertise. And especially when I'm talking to people who aren't professionals in that field, and I immediately get kind of like, oh, I know a lot here, and maybe I can teach them something. And even sometimes when I read or hear something really, really basic about Buddhism or meditation or technique or something, there's this little part of my brain that's like, oh, I already know all that. And, whatever, I don't need to read it again. And I realized that it's not always so useful for me to like approach it that way. And that maybe if I pause and just step back and let go of that sort of ego, I can maybe learn something new, and also give other people the opportunity to share what they know, and have more equanimity in the communications and stuff like that. So I'm not sure again if that's in the realm of an example, but just something I've noticed.
Great.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's just useful to know when we're at the spectrum, at the end of the spectrum where we're, I don't really matter, that we don't act when there's a necessity for acting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't really matter. So that's the suffering involved there. And at the other end of the spectrum, we may take action, and based upon the fact that we think we're the expert and we're not really noticing that, oh, that really missed the mark, that action. So that's the relationship that I was thinking of in terms of those two ends of the spectrum. So, okay, so let's take a break. Thank you all for sharing and for your discussion. And we'll come back at 2:30?
2:25? Well, no, because it's 2:20 now, so it's 10-minute break.
2:30? 2:30? Okay, 2:30. Come back.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, can everyone hear me? Looks like most everyone's back. Anybody that isn't, I guess they'll join us when we when they come. So we're about halfway through the program. This is the fourth element we're working with now. And as we talked about it when we first started, there the whole system generally, as has been noticed, is divided into three general areas: the wisdom area, the ethics area, and the training part of the Eightfold Path. And we're halfway through the Sila or ethics period, so we're kind of in the middle here. And hopefully it's been a useful program so far. In dealing with ethics, what I would like to do is I would like to step a little bit back from the action topic. I'll come back to it. And I want to talk a little bit about Buddhist ethics as a kind of a background and perspective as to why this is more than just what we have in the West, where you basically have a judgmental thing, that things tend to fall of the good things to do and the bad things to do. And what are supposed to do is, you know, follow the commandments that tell us the good things to do. And if we do the good things, we're a good person. And that's not the perspective that Buddhism has. Buddhism actually has a much more pragmatic and practical aspect to it. And it's sometimes we have to go back and look at the history of Buddhism, and we have to go back and think about the context in which some of this was done, to get a little bit broader perspective in our times. One of the places that I want to put in just as a preface to this is that back in the time of the Buddha, and actually before the time of the Buddha, their way of thinking about things was slightly different than ours. In the West, and particularly because of science and its utility, we have adopted a Greek system of logic that's a two-valued logic system. Things are true and they're false. Something can be in this category A, or it can be in this category B, and they tend to be somewhat mutually exclusive. And that's really a pragmatically important way of thinking about things. It's given us science, it's given us technology, it's given us medicine, it's given us very many other important things. But the Buddhist system, and in fact the Vedic system that predates that, was a four-valued system. There was true, or a category of A and a category of B, but they also had categories for something being both true and false, or in category A and category B. And they had another category in which it was neither true nor false in neither of those categories. And if you read the suttas, in a lot of cases, when he is talking about things, he will bring up those four different categories. And that's kind of important in what we're doing here in the Eightfold Path and also in ethics, because out of that in Buddhist thinking came the idea of the two truths. And in the two truths, what this is something that people, mystical people, whatever, in our modern age tends to look back to that time and get a somewhat erroneous position or idea that that type of Buddhist thinking was in advance of some of our European thinking, particularly when you get into some of the realms of science, things like quantum mechanics, where at least in the popular view, things like particles and stuff, maybe particles, there may be waves, maybe neither particles nor waves, or both particles, maybe. And it confuses people when they kind of run into this in the popular thing. But in Buddhism, you had a very similar type thing. And that is that the world, the reality, was considered to be made up of two different truths. Both true, both of which were held to be true. It wasn't a matter of one of them was a delusion or one of them is an error. And one of those truths that's very important was the conditional world. And within that, you have the provisional self. So you will find throughout Buddhist teachings this idea that, you know, of action here, we're talking about that. The right action, according to the Buddha, was to not kill, not to harm other sentient, not to harm sentient beings, not to take life. It was not to take what didn't belong to you, and it was not to engage in sexual misconduct, which at that time was mostly a masculine concept because of the society. So this was our everyday world. On the other hand, you get this idea of anatta, of non-self. And if you're not careful, you think that, oh, anatta is which was the ground, is the truth. And this idea that there of the self is an illusion that is on top of it. And that's not what the Buddha was saying. That's not what the logic of the time was saying. It was saying that both of these things are very true, that we do, in fact, live in a world in which we have a provisional conditioned self. But as Susan was saying, it's a verb. It's a process that's taking place, that's moving and changing and evolving. It's not a permanent thing. And you have the truth of anatta, in which the Buddha was saying there is no permanent self. He wasn't saying there was no self. He was saying there is no permanent self. And that's an important thing to understand. And so when you get into the Eightfold Path, if you look at the writings, you'll see that it talks about two different ways that those teachings are meant to be understood. One of them, they talk about it being Lokiya teachings. Lokiya is a word that came to us from that time, and when it made it into the English language, it came to mean it interpreted as we use the word location or a place. And it means, it gets translated as worldly. So these are the teachings as meant to be interpreted from that provisional self, from that place in the world. And so in that sense, the teachings of things such as not killing, not harming, those were meant to be things that you did do. And they were done because they gave you a foundation for society, a foundation for living with your fellow human beings that could be peaceful, that could be conducive to not creating turmoil. Whereas the idea that if you engaged in violence, you engaged in theft and so forth, you would be creating a social order, you'd be creating a place and a time where strife and would both prevent you from having the time and the focus to work with yourself, and also would create a environment in which people lived that was very harmful and damaging, and certainly did not lead to the end of suffering. At the same time, those teachings are also meant to be interpreted in what is called, what is known as the Lokottara form. Exactly the same teachings. This is, they have two different values, two different ways of looking at them. The Lokottara teachings are meant to be the teachings that lead to liberation, that lead to freedom. And they do not focus on a lot of the content in the same way. It is not necessary to, I mean, one of the teachings obviously is that you have no, that you don't kill. And in the extreme back then, it was carried into the Jain traditions, whereby in the Jain tradition, you know, they'll have a little broom that they sweep in front of them to move out of the way any insects, anything as they walk along a path to make sure that they don't do that. But in the Lokottara teachings, it's not really necessary to go that far. It's understood that what you're looking at is not fulfilling this right and wrong and good and evil type thing, but rather trying to free the mind. And in that context, if you actually go back and look at the precepts in the Parimokkha, which was what the monks trained, the phrasing of the precepts are a little bit different. The precepts that go towards right action were actually taken as, I undertake the training to refrain from destroying living creatures. I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not given. I undertake the training to refrain from sexual misconduct. So the focus for the monks, the focus for a lot of that, was not so much that they were supposed to be paragons of virtue, but rather that this eightfold path was a mechanism of training the mind, of training to understand what would bring about suffering, what would bring about this type of, what actions, what speech, what things would bring about in the mind these types of training, which is one of the reasons that then this leads into mindfulness, it leads into concentration, because these become training techniques were doing this. And the Buddha in the Eightfold Path goes back and looks at the causes of suffering that we're trying to deal with. And it's recognized that craving, that aversion, and that delusion are fundamental to those. So in order then to refrain from taking, from killing, in order to refrain from taking what's not yours, there is this need to recognize those mind states, those traits in the mind that lead to the desire to do that. You know, when you are inclined to harm another living being, there is usually a pre-existing mind state, as Susan noted, to doing that, an intent. And that intent is usually built on one of these poisons, something such as aversion, such as craving, such as delusion. And if you don't recognize that, what happens is you end up staying in a rut, and it's a rut of automatic action. And simply in the arising of that craving, there is suffering. Because in the arising of that craving, to want something or aversion to want to get rid of something, you're already in a state in which the mind thinks something is not right. This is wrong. This is a place I don't want to be. This has to be changed in order for me to be happy. So even before you reach out to create that action, before you even reach out to take something, you are already, by having those mind states arise in the mind and being subject to them, you've already put yourself into a place of creating the suffering that you're trying to get away from. So what the training is then doing, what the intent of the training is to get you to the point where as these mind states start to arise, as you start to experience these things, you become aware of them. And that's part of the reason that mindfulness is so important, that this is the process of seeing what's actually happening. Delusion itself, which is one of these three, is the mind state in which you're denying what is actually happening. That what is taking place around you is either ignored or transformed into some way and something that is different. So then the focus from this Lokottara point of view, and this is important to our practice as our practice deepens as we go forward, is not so much on judging whether this thought of arising in your mind has content that makes you a good or bad person, or this is a good or bad thing to be thinking about or doing, but rather on being able to be aware in the moment enough to see when that inclination, when that intention starts to arise, and what do you do with it? You know, when we talk about how we work in the world with a lot of this, we keep coming back to the idea that between the arising of the thought and the action, there's a place. There's a place where you can make a choice about what is the skillful way forward. And that's where Buddhism focuses. It's not the mind is going to have these mind states arise. I don't think that the Buddha or anybody else felt it wasn't. There are Buddhist tracts where he talks about, in fact, that this stuff is going to arise even in his own mind. I think that's a consequence simply of being who and what we are. We're evolutionarily configured to survive in the world, you know, as any other being is. The animal realm is considered to be somewhat below the human realm simply because it doesn't have this ability to be cognizant of the arising of these emotional states out of the physical reality that's around us. We are supposed to be in a little bit more favored position because of the fact that we have that ability to be aware when it arises. But that takes work, that takes practice, that takes effort. And that's really what the training that these precepts are talking about when it says, I undertake the training. I resolve to train to deal with these things. I resolve to do that. It's not saying you shouldn't have the feelings. It's not saying you shouldn't have the thoughts. What it's saying is when those thoughts and feelings are present, hopefully you can be aware that their thoughts are present. And then you can stop and decide, what are the consequences of what I do? When the Buddha talked to his own son, Rahula, about this, you know, he put forth to him that before you take an action, you should think about what are the consequences to myself and others. If you come to the conclusion that the consequences of this action are going to cause not be beneficial, that they're going to cause harmfulness to myself or harmfulness to others, that you should stop and not carry forth with that action. That if doing while you're doing that action, you should be aware of what the consequences that are arising, and in that moment, make a decision. Are you doing harm or are you doing things that are beneficial or neutral? If you're doing harm, you may choose to stop at that point. And then afterward, you can't always know what's going to happen. Afterward, you recommend that you reflect on your actions and the things you do and determine afterwards, did this cause harm? Not to blame yourself. Not to say that these actions are bad, but rather to look at this conditioned nature of action and the conditioned nature of the world that, and determine whether in the future there might be a different way of doing things. Because the problem with the conditioned world is not mercy. I've gone through my own practice. I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out good analogies for what's kind of going on here. And it's not a good analogy. I've got one of the ones I've come to is it's sort of like weather, or it's sort of like climate. If you look, we look at the world two ways in that situation too. If you're in the middle of a hurricane, or you're here and you see an atmospheric river coming down on us, that's a thing. That's a thing you have to deal with. That's a thing that's quite real. But if you step back away from it, if you step back to maybe a weather satellite or something, and you look down into what's happening, there are no hurricanes. There's just this gigantic interaction of causes and conditions, and in your own life, you don't have control over all those causes and conditions. So to blame yourself for getting angry, or blame yourself for having a thought arise that you might actually want to harm someone, that's not something you necessarily control. That's something that's arising cause and condition. What you do have control of is when you recognize that it's arising, when you see what's happening, and or it's then possible to pause and ask yourself, what is skillful? What do I do here? And so that, and this applies to speech, this applies to livelihood, it actually applies to all of Buddhist ethics, that the emphasis is not on some type of absolute good and bad, but rather on skillful means and on being aware of what is actually taking place, so that you are in the position to make choice, because choice and freedom can't be separated. You know, we're talking about becoming liberated. We're talking about gaining freedom. And that freedom comes through the fact that we have cultivated the ability to make choices. Yeah.
I wonder if people have questions.
If people have questions, we'll take, yeah.
There's a lot going on in that 20 minutes of.
I know that.
Yeah. I have some questions, but I'm...
Could I get you to do this, though, so you will...
Sure.
Yeah. So people online can hear. And if people online have questions, we'll take those, too.
So what I'm hearing is... but this whole topic brings up a lot of current issues about people.
Mm-hmm.
And current decisions people make about being vegetarian, not being vegetarian, when's it okay to kill and not to kill, and all those kinds of things. And it seems like what you're saying is there's a, when you talk about ethics in a Buddhist perspective, that it's really different from morality that we would normally see morality.
Not exactly, but let's go back to where I started, which is that in Buddhism are these two truths. Things that we're talking about here, things such as when as killings in Western things tends to be more black and white, and it tends a little bit more gray in Buddhism. And it basically comes down to the fact that there are different consequences. There are always consequences. There's always consequences in the mind, which I'll get into in a second. But obviously, you go back to the idea of, say, Hitler. You know, somebody had killed Hitler. You have this thing that there is some benefit to that, but it's still taking life. So it's not a black and white thing. And Buddhism recognizes ethics. It's not black and white. But it puts those types of decisions into the social area, into you and me living together as these conditioned beings, conditioned selves that need to get along, need to, if we're going to be happy, if we're going to have the best possible world we can, we have these compromises and other things we have to make. But it recognizes that when you start addressing those issues in the realm of Lokottara, they in some ways don't matter. Because that killing, whether I'm killing somebody, it's justified as opposed to completely unjustified, is not going to change the fact that that's going to kick back in my own mind, in my own practice, and there is going to be a suffering from it, a consequence from it. That justification doesn't matter there. It's going to, that killing, that act of killing is going to have a consequence in my ability to liberate myself, in my ability to escape my own internal suffering from that. So it doesn't say that morality is not important, but it recognizes that morality belongs in a certain realm, and there's another realm of liberation in which that morality, it's not that it's not important, it's that it's not quite so relevant. It doesn't really make a difference. And that's why you have to have, that's why I said at the start, that it's important to have this perspective of where Buddhist ethics came from, that there's a little bit different where in Western culture, it's kind of more lumped into one core. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think for me, part of it is, I hear the non-killing is central to Buddhist practice. And yet I know that the Dalai Lama's doctor, I'm told, told him he needed to eat meat to stay healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And there was people sometimes talk about if you don't do the actual killing of the animal, but you eat it, but someone else kills it, that's a different thing. And I've always struggled with that.
Yes, and a lot of people do. But let me say this. The Buddha was not a vegetarian. And in fact, Devadatta, I've mentioned before, his cousin, made it an issue in the Sangha. He tried to displace the Buddha as head of the Sangha to some extent by trying to get the Buddha to force, to make a decree that all monks had to be vegetarian, and the Buddha refused. He would not do that. His reasoning to some extent was that the monks in the Sangha lived on the alms rounds of the population. It didn't make any sense for him, since meat was a part of the natural diet of the time and the place and everything else, to send his monks out in the streets to tell the population they were dependent upon, no, we won't eat your food. It's not good enough because it's meat. You have to make something special for us that, you know, or we won't go to your house to eat. He felt that from a social and other context, that was not an appropriate way for the Sangha to be behaving, mm-hmm. particularly in a society. And as I said, the idea of whether you, this type of thing of whether you should be vegetarian or not is a social decision, and has changed in various places, that it was not appropriate to be doing. And again, this idea of stepping forward and stepping back. If you step back away from sitting down at your own meal, and you look at the whole ecosystem of chemistry, if you will, biochemistry and everything else, the reuse of all of that material, all of the biochemicals, all of the other things that are very expensive to create, is part of the natural order. I mean, you're certainly not going to have the environment, the biology of the planet, and everything else that you would have if you didn't, if there weren't something eating meat out there, because it would be building up, or you know, something has to degrade it back into the ecological cycle. So what the Tibetans do, and you're right, the Dalai Lama actually eats meat every other day. It's partially the doctor. It's also partially the recognition of the thing that we're talking about here, that it's not a clearly defined thing. And they're not the only ones. Japanese tend to eat meat. There's Burmese, even though they're Theravadan, they have a meat in their diet as well. So it's not that all Buddhists are vegetarian. But what the Tibetans tend to do is they have sky burial. So what happens when you die, they put your body up on sky platforms for the carrion eaters to take all the flesh off of them, and they eat you. And they consider that to be the normal way of recycling the body to the environment.
Mm.
And even here in this culture, there's some starting to be a movement towards, rather than simply cremating bodies and doing things like that, to ecologically degrade them back to the natural components and putting them back into the environment too. So it's not entirely clear that vegetarianism is an absolute. It rather, it's a social convention. And yes, I think the reason that we talk about killing for you or not killing for you is, again, there from the liberation side of it, there's no escaping that there will be suffering, that there will be consequences to killing. I think I've mentioned before, there's a story in the Jataka Tales in which the Buddha was a captain of a refugee ship that was attacked by pirates. And in that thing, in order to protect all the refugees on that boat, he killed the head of the pirates, knowing that there would be a consequence to it, knowing that he would be in a future lifetime spend time in hell. Even though in that sense it might have been justified, there was a consequence he could not escape for having chosen to do that.
So is there a karmic difference between the butcher and the people who buy the meat? I'm hearing there is.
Yes. Yes, there is. A Buddhist monk on alms round cannot accept food that he knows has been specifically killed for him. So if you go on alms round and somebody says, oh, our favorite monk's coming, kill a chicken and we'll give it to him. And the monk finds out, he has to refuse that. Because there it goes beyond what the Buddha would accept. So,
thank you. I think that may have died. That might.
Are there any other questions or any other people that would like to clarify things? Okay, if not, then we'll do possibly do another breakout session. And so I want to read something that Philip Moffat wrote. And this is what he said. Whenever I address a topic of violence against self in a Dharma talk, almost everyone squirms. No one wants to hear it. I will directly ask the question, are you, in an obvious manner or a series of subtle covert actions, being violent with yourself? Usually people want to assure me that while they may work too hard at times, stay in an unhealthy relationship, eat too much, or sleep too little, they would not characterize their behavior as violence towards themselves. Yet person after person, once they closely examine their lives, experience a moment of self-recognition that at first can be painful and embarrassing. This initial discomfort is often followed by a sense of liberation as new possibilities arise in their imagination about how to live more peacefully. One of these discoveries is the degree to which we make life difficult for ourselves by violating the body and the mind in the routine of our daily lives. Through the way in which we schedule our time, push our bodies, and compare and judge ourselves against others, we repeatedly create an inner environment that is filled with violence. If you can understand that this is so, it may have a profound effect on the experience of your life being difficult. So I would like you to think about that. And that's the question. Do you perpetrate violence on yourself? And do you treat yourself differently than you would treat other people? From an ethical point of view, do you think that because it's you can get away with treating yourself that way? So I'll go ahead and put you off into groups for 15 minutes, and that's the question I'd like you to reflect on. Okay? So, is there anyone either in the room or online that would like to say anything about how they felt about that exercise? You don't have to go into the details if you don't want, but just was it a useful exercise? Does it help you to understand wise action any better? So, anyway, either online or in the room. It helps the people online because right. They can hear you that way.
Yeah, and that so too. Yeah.
One comment that was made when we were starting was that it was a very intimate question. And I think that's true. And I think it was a question that really required a lot of thought and some being vulnerable and not that easy to process and verbalize and for me it was somewhat emotional. Yeah,
I think that's why Philip Moffat's comments at the beginning of it were that when he raises this question, it's everyone in the room squirms. That's pretty much the universe reaction to it.
Yeah.
Anyone else online or in the room? If there's someone online, you can unmute yourself and come into the room. Okay, comment, Paula, or anyone?
You're muted, Paula. There you go.
There?
Yes, now we can hear you.
I have to do it in two places. I just wanted to say, I think that we did, all three of us were able to identify, you know, ways that we actually do perpetuate violence or perpetrate, I should say, violence on ourselves. And but something I realized at the beginning is it just sounds so odd to me to use the word violent there, you know, and I thought that was part of my issue at first. I don't do violence to myself, you know, but then of course I realized what violence I do to myself. And it's just because it's whatever I do that hurts me, you know, and I just wasn't thinking of it in terms of that word, but I conceive it, you know, it hurts me. And so it does damage. So I realize that it is. And I think the three of us all had good examples in our life of what we're doing. And we talked about ways that we could change. You know, we certainly have the choice. We can choose to change. And it's not always easy, but it's very freeing and liberating. And that's what we want. We want peace of mind and a clear conscience. And so I'm not going to bed at night and going, oh, why didn't I do that? You know, I figured out a way that I don't have to do that anymore. So.
Yeah, and it is a big and as you said, intimate topic. And it wasn't necessarily my intent that you drill down, nor do we give you enough time to drill down deeply into it.
Yeah.
But what it hopefully does is this is something you can take into the next month as we think about and work with the questions and things that come up in Right Action. And, you know, exploring your own reflections, because that's where it makes the difference. It's not me hearing it. It's not, it's really within your own practice where it's done. And then if you do have a mentor, then that, and you have some questions about it at the end of the month, it's a good place to raise it. And Paula, if you want a mentor, let us know. We'll arrange for you to have one still.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for telling me.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone, anything else? Okay. Well, we're approaching the end of the day anyway. So, maybe we'll just sit for a couple minutes here and, digest what's happened today. Thank you very much for coming. As I'll remind everybody, next month, we are moving the date. I've changed it on the calendar already. So if you go to the website, IAC website, it will show this meeting and the Zoom link on the 18th and not on the 11th. But I will also send out an email the week before the 11th just to make sure that we don't have, if you want to show up here, Gil will be here. So that would be a good thing to go to, but you won't expect to be coming to the 8-foot path on that day. Okay, so let's just quietly sit. We've generated a lot of merit by today being here, by working with these things, by helping to focus on our suffering and the suffering in the world, both that created by us and that created by others. And the response, I think, of the heart to that is to want peace, to want happiness, to want to end that suffering. That's the natural inclination of the mind. That's the natural inclination for all beings, all sentient beings, not just humans. So let's take the merit we've created. Let's take the goodwill, the feelings of loving kindness that we've generated, and offer it to all beings. Offer it to the world in general, that all beings may find the way to the reduction of suffering, that all beings may find the way to help, that all beings may find the way to happiness. It can be done, and it's not that we have to become saints to do it. It's that we have to become mindful to do it. That the world needs to become mindful. Because when it is, it recognizes the inclination, the natural inclination of the heart, the natural inclination of the heart of all beings. Oh, thank you very much. I've enjoyed the day with you. Hopefully it's been worthwhile to you, for you as well.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.